Hello and welcome to The Appetite, a podcast brought to you by Opal Food and Body Wisdom. I'm Kara Bozzi, a licensed marriage and family therapist, co-founder and clinical director of Opal, as well as the head of the exercise and sport program. The Appetite is about all things food, body, sport, and mental health. Today, I'm honored and delighted to be having a conversation with Amelia Boone, a corporate attorney and decorated athlete in obstacle racing and ultra running. To me, however, Amelia is so much more than her impressive accomplishments. I had the great privilege of getting to know her through her stint of eating disorder treatment at Opal, which means I got to know her on a much deeper level, her inner workings, as she bravely pursued the tough and uncomfortable work of recovery. So this is a particularly special episode to be able to interview Amelia and use this podcast platform to have an honest conversation together. For those of you who don't know Amelia, she's very active in the social media world in the intersection of sports. She has a big following, and I totally get it. She's candid, she's honest about her ups and downs as an athlete, as well as giving voice to contribute to the eating disorder recovery conversations. And when she was at Opal, one of the conversations we had was trying to figure out how open she wanted to be about her eating disorder, especially on these public platforms, given that she was in the process of recovery herself and still struggling. And I remember really appreciating those conversations we have and knowing it's complicated and there isn't a right answer of trying to figure out that balance of both taking care of yourself, your own recovery, and then also giving to others and giving back to communities. So although there are many things Amelia could talk about, I thought this would be a good conversation to center around advocacy work or helping other people when the thing we are advocating for or educating or supporting others is related to something we've personally struggled with. So my hope is that this is relatable to all of us, exploring how do we know what we need, whether that's to set boundaries, take a step back from conversations with others, or move towards and speak up. So here we go. To start, Amelia, welcome. And why don't you start to share? We'll begin with you sharing a bit about your recovery journey and where you are today, just so the listeners can get to know you a bit.
Yeah. Hi, Kara. And I teared up a little bit at that introduction because it takes me back to all my days at Opal. And yeah, it was actually about 3 years ago that I came to Opal for treatment. And it wasn't my first rodeo in treatment. I definitely have struggled for a long time with an eating disorder. And I was first diagnosed when I was 16 years old. And I think for me, when I came to Opal, I was 35. And I told myself, I'm too old for this. I shouldn't be here. But it was something that I know that I needed to address. And it had been amplified by being an athlete and being a competitive athlete and actually like being in the public eye, a lot of focus around my body. And I started to really not know if I could untangle my eating disorder from sport, if I could engage in sport and running and things I love to do in a healthy manner. And so at the age of 35, I decided to come to Opal, and I spent about 3 months with you all there in Seattle. And I remember the first 2 weeks just being like, I don't want to be here. Get me out of here. I don't belong here. And I'm sure that so many people have that experience as well. And so, yeah, about 3 years later, I am still on my journey every single day. And I would say overall, doing really well. There have been ups and downs. The pandemic has been a very tough time in terms of like continuing on that journey. But I believe that I'm in a good place now, though I will by no means say I am recovered with an ED at the end. I do believe that this is an ongoing process for me. And that 20 years of a disorder isn't going to disappear, very quickly. So that's the kind of the journey that I'm on.
Yeah. And also, I guess, to this, because of where we're bringing this conversation, Maybe share a bit more about how you kind of decided to get actively engaged in social media, and maybe other ways that you've brought your kind of inner experience or your recovery journey to others. Like sort of what brought about making those decisions, and we'll get more into that as we get into this conversation, but maybe just the beginning of that. What went into that?
Yeah. So I think when I was there at Opal, I remember discussing with you, like, can I talk about this publicly? If I talk about it publicly, I can't unring that bell. And especially as somebody who's an athlete, like, what would that do? And how would people see me differently? Would people treat me differently? Would people like have all eyes on me while I'm eating dinner with them and they're just picking apart? And I think that weighed in my head, but I honestly had this very strange cognitive dissonance for the past 20 years of my life, which was that all of these people saw me as this incredible world champion athlete and who was extremely in shape. And I would get a lot of comments on how great my body was. And internally, I knew everything that I was doing was so disordered and like was just not healthy. And that tore me apart inside. And the fact that my outer world wasn't matching what was going on in my inner world. And so it was very important for me. One of my values is really transparency and honesty. And so I decided to, a few weeks after I left Opal, I wrote a blog post. Yes, some people still blog. And about my experience and about hiding this and the fact that, you know, I realized the reason I had had 6 stress fractures in the past 3 years was because, I wasn't feeding myself appropriately. And it gained a lot of attention, and Outside Magazine published it. And, you know, people started being like, you know, me too. And people started being able to relate. And so I think I was nervous. I was nervous of the response. And I was also nervous, like, does this pigeonhole me into kind of the girl with the eating disorder, you know? And I didn't really want to be that. I wanted to be able to talk on various things. But I also was very passionate about this. And the more I think that I opened up, the more that I realized, like, what a big problem this is and how many people do struggle. And I was so ashamed for 20 years. I thought it was an awful thing. I was told by many people that I, you know, could never find a partner because I struggled with this, or I, you know, like that I was always going to be kind of odd, or I was the person with a mental illness. And I just wanted to take away that shame, because for me, that shame kind of thrives when you keep it inside. And so I decided to bring it outside into the world.
Yeah. So it sounds like it really, I mean, it started with for yourself of breaking down that cognitive dissonance between what the world saw of you and what all of, again, was going on inside, which is, I think, very relatable to folks with eating disorders, is sort of that almost hidden struggle of a lot of people in their life not knowing what's going on and the impact that has on oneself to have that dissonance. And so it sounds like that was the motivation, the start of treading into that territory. But in doing so, then it sounds like a lot of folks were connecting with you. And I guess that makes me just get curious around the role of it being for your own self and to feel more integrated as a person, as well as then seeing like what you were offering to other people and the power that was having for other people to be able to be more open mm-hmm. and share their struggle. And I guess, yeah, where does that, I want to hear more about that, of both of those parts of it being present.
Yeah. And it's such a good question, because I actually, it's not like I ever set out to inspire anyone or to change the conversation. I think for me, it was honestly, and I think I told people at this time, it was actually kind of a selfish motivation, because I wanted to feel integrated as a whole person. And I think to this day, still, when I talk about it, is very much talking about it from a perspective of these are things that I am trying to figure out. And these are things that I am learning. And this is my journey along the way. And what I found is that like the side effect of that is that it actually speaks to people and helps people, that these things that are going on in my head are not strange one-offs that I thought like I was alone in forever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm. And so being able for me to then like write about them and speak about them. And a lot of, you know, what I have talked about is actually how do I untangle sport with the disorder, and can I untangle it? And I think that that's the message that has really resonated with a lot of people, because people don't know. They don't know. The question is what I'm doing disordered? Is what I am doing healthy? Am I just being an athlete? Mm-hmm. And so kind of through these conversations in my head, it's been things that other people have been able to relate to. And honestly, I mean, which is phenomenal. At the same time, like I do realize I open myself, when you speak into the public, you open yourself up to criticism. And 99%, I get a lot of positive feedback from people and being able to connect. At the same time, I do have a few people who question what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. And I think that that's like a fear that is very real. When you decide to speak up about something, to share your experience, all of a sudden your life becomes fodder for people to comment on.
Totally. Yeah.
And so I think it's something that, you know, I've had to struggle with, like, am I emotionally stable enough to share those parts of myself, you know, and withstand that for sure.
And what have you learned about that in terms of how to discern that? Or is that just, is that an ongoing, I imagine that's probably an ongoing journey of, it's like what I hear is the risk reward aspect of, you can see maybe a lot of reward for your own self. You can see the reward mm-hmm. of folks that are connecting to you and being more honest. But what are, the risks involved in that are opening yourself up to criticism. I'm imagining there might be other risks, but maybe, how do you navigate that risk reward or because it's also not predictable, I imagine, as we all know with social media of when criticism might come your way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think for me, I kind of navigate, it's like, how tender is a subject in the moment? Like if it's something that if I realize by me speaking on it is just going to catapult me into a small relapse or like flare the thoughts or something like that, then it's probably not the right time. You know, there is a reason that I waited, you know, until I got out of treatment at Opal to write about it, to speak about it. Because I, you know, in that moment while I was there, I was not capable of actually even reflecting on it or understanding what was going on or where I was going with this. And, you know, for me, the reward has always been, I suppose anyone who's been in a process group with me knows that I externally process everything. Like that is just how I am able to make sense of the world, is by speaking it, is by putting it out there. And in that regard, feeling less alone. Mm-hmm. And so for me to be able to share an experience with someone, and I've made a lot of connections by speaking about this, like knowing that I'm not alone in it and having people who see me and understand me outweighs the few people who decide that they are able to say whatever they want and comment on whatever they want and you know, say mean things that I won't repeat right now.
Sure. Totally.
So you always have to remember that there's always one person on the internet who is just going to ruin it for you.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. The other risk I felt curious about is, how would I put this? Do you feel like you can be right where you're at, or do you, like, in your struggle, in your questioning, in your processing, or do you feel like because of what others, the inspiration people are pulling from you, or do you feel some sort of pressure to be farther than you are, or that you have figured it out more than you actually have? It makes me think of how often it's when you start to see the impact you can make in another person's life, then it starts to enter and maybe into the realm of at sometimes feeling like a hypocrite or an imposter, or can I be helpful for this person if I'm still struggling? So I guess, yeah, I just feel curious around that part of it for you as well of, is it challenging to stay kind of just right where you're at in your own process with getting all this input from others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. And right now I actually, and honestly through all of this, I have not felt that. I know previously. So when I was in high school and I went to college and I thought that I had gone through treatment in high school and I thought I am recovered. I have beaten the eating disorder. And I remember speaking to like my sorority in college and telling everybody that that was in my past and you can beat an eating disorder too, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next year I relapsed hard. And it was awful. And then I was ashamed about the fact that I had proclaimed I was this recovered girl. And then look at me, I then was almost kicked out of school and I had to go to residential treatment again. And so for me, it's actually an ego check to be very, very honest about where I am. And I also remember in deciding to go back into treatment, I would look around for people who talked about their experiences in eating disorder recovery. And every person I could find always talked about it as they are recovered. Mm-hmm. I used to have a problem and I got therapy and now my life is so phenomenal because I am recovered. Mm-hmm. And I never saw voices that were like, I am struggling through this right now and this is what I'm going through and it's not perfect. And I think for me, it felt right to be very like, these are the ups and the downs and the things that I am figuring out. Cause I never wanted to be the person that was like, I have it all figured out. Cause I don't know about you, but I personally don't trust people who tell me that they have everything figured out. They definitely don't.
Yeah. which is interesting though, Amelia, because, we can be candid here. That was part of the dialogue, you and I had while you were in Opal. And the personal experience I brought to you was different than yours, right? So I certainly don't have everything figured out in life. There's certainly a lot of struggles, but I do consider myself recovered from an eating disorder. And I didn't go public with, I didn't do public talks. I didn't do anything kind of public with some of my advocacy work until I actually did consider myself in that kind of recovered spot. And so I know as we were discussing that, that was part of the like, well, what, you know, some of the risk and the experimentation with this of I didn't have my own experience to reflect back. And I'm sure you had some feelings even towards me in that of I am one of those people that that has been more open about it after feeling recovered. And I want to make clear again, that doesn't mean that my life is all put together, but certainly from that eating disorder perspective, feeling like I wasn't in a spot of still struggling when I mm-hmm. when I became more public. So
yeah.
Anyhow.
And I fully respect that because I also, maybe there's a part of me, like if I'm completely honest, that I'm a little bit jealous of people who say that they're fully recovered because like, I'm not there yet, you know, like, and I don't really know what full recovery looks like to, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I am, I don't know how you define recovery, which is hard because like, for me, I'm at this phase now where like, there are little voices sometimes in the back of my head that chirp at me, but I'm able to say, no, not listening to you, like go away, you know, doing other things, but it is still a very like conscious decision on my part to like continue to engage in recovery. And like, there are, but like the little, I always thought for me, I considered recovery would be like the voices would be plucked out of my head. I would never hear anything about like, oh, maybe you shouldn't eat that. And that they would just like, it was like somebody would do a lobotomy and take them out of me. And I have not found that to be the case. They're much, much quieter. They're much like, you know, it's not all encompassing in my life, but like, and I'm like, maybe if I just keep chipping away and keep going in that direction, then like at some point I'm like, oh, it's been, you know, several months and I don't hear, you know,
Sure.
So it is just like part of that process. And I also want to say for many people, like, and probably yourself too, is that it is a it is a phenomenal thing to keep the recovery process to yourself, to hold it to yourself, to get to that place. You know, because a lot of people, that's how they process the world, is not by talking to hundreds of thousands of people on the internet. And that is completely fine. It may actually be easier that way. I don't know.
Well, and there's, you know, most people don't have that huge following. And it is, I think, the relatable piece for most of us is, where are we putting ourselves out there, right? So for me, where I relate to this is earlier in my recovery, when I decided to go into this field, I remember I was going to get engaged with a eating disorder recovery support group when I was in graduate school. And at that point, I would not have said I was fully recovered. I was in a good spot, but I didn't know. I didn't know. I knew I thought I wanted to help folks that had eating disorders, but I didn't know. And I had that feeling of being maybe a hypocrite or an imposter. And I didn't know what that would do for my own recovery process to be supporting folks in that way. And it was a risk. It was a risk to get involved in that group, but it felt like an important risk because there was at least a really large part of me that knew I wanted to go into this field and help people like me. And yet I didn't actually know how that would go. And so it felt like this experimentation. And what I found in doing that is it wasn't something that was actually consistently setting me back. It was bolstering, and if anything, bolstering my recovery. But I didn't know that would be the case. I had to do it to find out. So I guess that's the part in my journey that I was kind of tenuous around, was entering the field of treatment of eating disorders. So I guess, yeah, maybe that's in some ways that whole risk reward. How do we listen to ourselves and be honest with ourselves about, you know, what are we doing to put ourselves, yeah, in that vein of helping others, and how do we keep ourselves in check with ourselves in that too.
Yeah. I actually remember a process group at Opal where I think we were discussing, you know, like, it was around the holiday, or like how to function over the holidays with family members who may say things, and like, should you advocate? Where are you on that scale? And I remember at one point saying, you know, and this is something I still think about myself for myself every single day when I decide whether to engage, is like, there is a time to advocate. There's a time to educate. And there is a time simply to like, take yourself out of the situation, mm-hmm. like just to leave, just to say, this is not something that I'm able to engage in right now, and set that boundary, mm-hmm. and, you know, and care for yourself in that way. And I think that that's an ongoing question that I have, that I ask myself all the time, is where am I in that process? And it can change day to day. I think some days that I need to just say, this is a boundary that I need to set today. This is not good for my own mental health to be engaging in these conversations or to be advocating. And so I'm just going to take a step back.
Yep.
And then there are other times where I feel like very passionate and I want to advocate today. And I think it's just kind of listening to yourself of what feels good in those moments.
Yeah. And you said earlier, one of the questions is how tender is the subject in the moment? I feel curious if there's particulars around this, around like emotions that you might be tracking, sensations that you might be thinking about, thoughts you might be kind of tracking of when you get to those decision moments of like, do I take a step back? Do I exit this situation? Do I take the break, or do I move towards? And I appreciate your saying the conversation that got brought up around family members, because again, I think the relatability of this the relatability is there, I think, for all of our listeners around when do we step in and when do we take a back seat. So yeah, I just feel curious if you have anything more around specifics that you think of that help kind of guide you, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really pay attention to, and it's going to be funny for anybody who knows me, because they know that I'm for a very long time was not in touch with my body, like feelings, you know, mm-hmm. I thought a lot, it was always thinking, but now I'm very good at like paying attention to like almost bodily sensations. Is that little fight or flight response that comes up in me. And if I start feeling that I'm getting to a place of like hyperstimulation and like fight or flight, then I realize like that is actually probably not a good scenario for me to engage. Mm-hmm. That it's something that like, that is a little bit too tender. That if I can't calmly and kind of like think through it, then it's in a scenario that is probably not healthy for me in the moment.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love hearing that. Yeah. There's some more development of the checking in with your body. That's awesome. That's cool. Yeah. I love it. And just to, and you know, I think it's also important to say we're not going to be perfect at this either. Like a lot of it is experimentation of kind of making a choice that actually ends up not feeling like good in the end and learning from that, because as we start to even just, yeah, pay attention to ourselves with making those decisions, there's a lot of mess ups. And I think that's also just like, as somebody who has more of the orientation towards perfectionism, I think it's important to say that there's a lot of mess ups with learning, with having more learning in that around discerning when to advocate and when to step back.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that in a way, I've also realized that it's easier for me to do it kind of like on a platform like social media versus like in person sometimes, because I think that I'm like overly aware of other people's feelings and emotions when I'm there with them one-on-one, you know, sure. And it's also easier for me to be triggered when I am there in person with somebody who in particular, like I think, or who is struggling or something like that. And I may be like trying to help in those scenarios. So I realized for me, that may be a step that I'm not super capable of still, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think a lot of people who are in recovery, like would like to advocate and would like to be a part of this, but it's like, okay, well, how can I do that while still protecting my own recovery while not triggering myself in those scenarios?
Right. Yeah, it's, I appreciate you saying that, because I think like this, so it makes a lot of sense that one of the benefits of social media is less stimulus, because in person you're having to react to the person in the moment, and that all of that is a lot less in our control, right? Around how the other person's going to engage, and if we have a strong radar up of sensitivities towards others, that can make it an additional challenge, right? To take those risks. So I appreciate you saying that. The other thing that came to mind is like the whole, when self-care looks like stepping away, setting a boundary. Other piece, and I wonder if you could speak to this, is like what we know about how helping others, like kind of the psychology and what we've learned, actually that's even backed up in research around how helping others can support our recovery, can support our mental health through giving us a sense of meaning and purpose through that help or through altruistic behavior, and kind of getting outside of ourselves, I guess, so to speak. So yeah, I feel curious around that as well, of kind of that part of the equation.
Yeah. And absolutely. I think that being able to, I know I personally struggle with being in my head a lot. I'm in my head, and I tend to do better when I do have a purpose and do have some meaning and I can give back. And so I think that that's kind of like when you're further along in the recovery journey, like you have that mental capacity and emotional capacity to be able to like give back, which then shores up your own recovery. Because also in a weird way, and this is very strange, but I do feel like being open with people about this also gives me an accountability as well. Like I know that I have, you know, 100,000 people who would be very disappointed if I relapsed. And that sounds very grand, but I just, in a way, I think that it does give me this weird sense of accountability that I'm like, okay, I've got this. And I'm cheering other people on who are struggling through this. They're cheering me on. And it does very much like fulfill some of those needs, I think, of that support and of that being able to give back, because we feel good when we do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, that's one of the things about eating disorders is it does really, you know, I think a lot of folks with eating disorders, I wouldn't call them inherently like self-absorbed, but the nature of an eating disorder is very self. You get in your head. There's a lot of obsessional thinking. There's a lot of fixation on food and body. And so like that is kind of inherent in eating disorders, right? And so, yeah, just thinking about how getting outside of ourselves in a meaningful way can be one strategy or a positive part to a recovery process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, you know, if you're not in a place to kind of, if you don't feel like in a place to give back in terms of like recovery too, like there are other ways to get outside of yourself than just via being active in the recovery community too. You know, I think before we started recording, I talked about how I started fostering dogs, which was a huge way for me to actually get out of my own head. And so I think that there's like a lot of different ways to do it. And for some people, they like being active in the recovery community isn't for them. And that would actually be detrimental to them. And in those scenarios, I said like, more power to you, like find something else that can give you that meaning as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. The other thing I was thinking about, Amelia, with, I guess going back to seeing and hearing all the benefits that you have experienced in both demonstrating your like honesty, feeling more integrated, giving back to folks, like you're talking about a lot of things that have been really positive in your social media experiences. And I also imagine you do get to hear a lot of other people's stories. And I would love to hear more about that, because I imagine then you're getting a lot of people opening up to you and probably seeking particular support from you. And so I guess I would love to hear more about that and what that part of the experience is like and what might be questions that you have around that or challenges that you have with that.
Yeah. And it's amazing. I get tons and tons of emails and messages of people sharing, you know, people and what they've gone through and things like that. And I'll be fully honest, when I first opened up about this, I got so many that they just got lost. I didn't respond to a lot of things. Because I also realized at the time, like it was just overwhelming for me. But I think that it's really cool for me to actually just like be like, oh, okay. So these things that I thought I was so alone in forever, I'm actually not alone, you know, and that there are other people. And there are people who have, you know, since gone into treatment because they're like, look, I like was struggling with the exact same thing. I didn't know, like, could I be an athlete and like be in recovery? Was I able to juggle these things? And here are the things that I'm learning.
Can I interrupt you for a second? I don't know if you know this, but there are actually quite a few folks that have come to Opal because of you. And I don't know if you get to hear that, if you get to see that come to fruition. But on my end, every time that happens, I have that moment, that emotional moment of tearing up, of seeing the impact that you've had in that way is really, really powerful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I know of one or two and they are doing really well, and which is phenomenal to me. And I think that that's the thing is that like, I came to Opal because I heard another professional runner speak about Opal and going there and her experience there. And so for me, I'm like, if I then can then pay that forward, you know, and then have those people who then going, whether it's Opal, a different treatment facility, and speak about this. And I think over the past few years, we've just seen like a blossoming of, especially in the athletic world, people saying like, no, I'm not going to hide this anymore. And I need to fix this. And I want to fix this. Mm-hmm. And the status quo in the athletic world is not okay. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that. And I'm sure that ripples across as well, across like to all communities too. And I've seen it like just more and more people being able to speak about it. And I think for me, that is huge. And just feeling like it's not something that I need to hide anymore and be ashamed of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm thinking particularly, you know, this is the particular, I guess, niche of elite level, professional level athlete and the barriers and particular concerns about entering treatment or getting support, that when you particularly speak out, just what that opens the door for with folks who identify with you. And I know a lot of the conversations that we have at Opal involve, you know, just our different identities. And we know that there's a lot of privilege that athletes have. Mm-hmm. Yet one of the things that comes up is when it comes to mental health and eating disorders, it's very difficult for high-level athletes to be forthright and to be honest about their eating disorder and the repercussions that might come from doing so. And so I guess I say that with the awareness of a lot of the privilege that comes with that, but then also where that the other side to that that makes it really difficult for athletes to seek support. So I don't know if I feel curious, like a lot of things you're probably, a lot of themes that you're probably getting from folks that are reaching out to you.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that it's something that people, you know, they've have coaches who have encouraged disorder and luckily that seems to be changing as we get more and more coaches into the space that are, you know, that are more educated on these kinds of topics, and that we steer away from conversations around racing and weight and what your body looks like and how that translates to how good you are at your sport. And so like, I am very heartened that there is a shift in this. And also at the same time, like I very much speak for a lot of athletes, but I also am very passionate. This comes from Opal about the fact that we as athletes need to zoom out sometimes and see, also acknowledge our privileges that we have and see that. And for anyone who is that eating disorders are not, you know, are not particular to the small subset of usually fit, you know, small runners who are unable to eat enough, you know, and that like, you can be in any size body to have an eating disorder. Some of the biggest pushback that I receive when I advocate around this is talking about HAES, health at every size, talking about people in larger bodies in recovery. That is where I actually get a lot of my pushback, my blowback. But I think that it's so important that for those of us who are do have, you know, are in a position of privilege, that these are also things that we need to talk about to normalize the discussion around eating disorders. Is that there, you know, yes, my community is very much an athlete community. And that is a lot of what I see and a lot of the experiences that I get. But I also get a lot of people reaching out to me who are like, thank you, I am in a larger body. Nobody believes me that I struggle. And it is so validating to know that like, you believe me. And I mean, like, those are the things that just like bring tears to my eyes, because like, no one should like, not feel believed based on, you know, the size of their body. And I think that that's an area that we still have a long way to go. In, yeah, you know, we're getting there.
I just got goosebumps when you said that. I just, yeah, it's such a huge part of breaking weight stigma and weight bias around this. When you have people reach out to you, are there times that you really struggle with, well, how do I support this person? How do you know, sort of, do you feel like it's challenging to figure out what the response is, what your role is, what it isn't? Yeah, I guess getting into a little bit more of how do you support someone that's going to open up to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, the number one thing for me is that I always need to preface that, like, I'm not a mental health professional. So like, this is just my experience. I'm not a doctor. Like, I don't, and that's also the attorney in me that just wants to disclaim all any type of liability for any advice that I may give, you know. But for me, like, I am very willing and open to share my experiences about, a lot of people want to know, like, what was it like in, you know, at Opal, what was it like in an intensive treatment facility, and what are places, where can I go? Like, and so for me, I'm really big on giving the resources and the tools, you know, to be able to handle it. I also know, you know, like, there are certain things that I don't want to go, like, I don't, or where places I don't want to go is that I, like, if a person starts talking to me about the number of calories that they're eating or their behaviors, and I'm just like, you know, that's not a place that I'm comfortable talking about. Like, that is more of a boundary, you know, that I have to draw.
Right.
And at the same time, then I get a lot of people who then reach out to me who say, you know, I see you in this and I want to support you. Like, how do I support? Or how do I support a loved one? Like, how do I do that? And it's funny because I think that as I've progressed further along in my recovery, the tables have kind of been turned for me, is that I've started to be part of a support system for people, as opposed to being the person who needs support. Mm. And I have a whole new level of respect for the people who are out there who are watching their loved ones struggle, because it is hard. And I don't think I ever gave, you know, my parents credit, my family credit, all my friends credit for how hard that must have been. And so in those scenarios, you know, well, like, what I always say, or what I always try to do as a supporter, is realize, like, I am here for you. I'm here for you. Like, what do you need? Like, how can I help? First of all, like, do you just need an ear to listen to? Like, would you like resources? And then also realizing that I can't fix it for them. And that's hard as a person who really, you know, wants to help, that knowing that no one in my life could have fixed this for me. You know, I had parents throw me into a hospital. I had people try and force me into residential treatment. None of it was going to work until I really wanted recovery to come from me. And so I think that for people in positions of support, it's really hard to separate that and to be like, okay, I can be here. I can be a resource, but I also need to not take it personally if they're just not ready yet, yeah. You know? And I think that that's one of the things that I've had to learn in that support role as well.
Yeah, Amelia, I'm so glad you're saying that, because I think that really aligns with what I have seen clinically with folks in supportive roles in our clients' lives, of this huge desire to help and support and having really struggling with knowing how to do that. And I think, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all answer to that. But generally, where I start with them is that it's totally okay to ask the loved one, like, what can I do to be supportive to you? And knowing that that changes, it could change, you know, within a day, it could change within a week, but to ask that question and see what their loved one wants and needs from them at that given point in the recovery process.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it's also something that I've realized myself as I've gone through this, is that it's also on me as the person in recovery to be able to say, like, I'm really struggling with this right now. And I may be upset about something or another. It has nothing to do with you. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think that especially sometimes, like, when the person is in that place of just everything seems hard and you're not in a good spot in your recovery, then you're going to be very emotional. You may be angry. You may be sad. You may be upset. And the support system clearly wants to fix that and make it better. And honestly, like, it just, sometimes it's just saying, like, you can't,
right.
Which is the worst thing ever. And right. God, I wish they could, you know? So
it means enduring a lot of suffering. I mean, I think for a loved one, it's so hard to watch this person they care deeply about be in pain and suffering, and like to tolerate that in somebody else is a huge task, but such an important task. such an important task because, as you know, the suffering is inherent in the recovery process. You can't bypass that part. And so, but the loved one has to watch that and be a witness to it. And it's really hard.
Oh God. Yeah. And, you know, and now kind of like seeing the reverse side of that. Cause I was always on the side of where like I was the one and I was like, well, why don't you understand? I'm just having a bad day. Don't take it personally, you know?
Yeah. Well, Amelia, this is so great to talk to you. I can't tell you how much pleasure this is for me to be able to have this conversation with you and reconnect with you. And I just am so, I'm even just impacted in this moment just to hear your continual journey and the way that you are showing up more honestly to yourself and going opposite to that shame in your life and in your community. And I just, I am really grateful for this chance to have this conversation. And I know our listeners are going to benefit a lot from hearing from you. And I just want to give a moment if there's any other things that you felt like we didn't cover or anything you'd want to share to the listeners before we wrap this conversation up.
Yeah, no, thank you. This has been, I've been giddy about getting the opportunity to chat with you again. It's been too long. Yeah. And just for anyone listening, if they do have questions, I have written a fair amount, like in blog posts of my journey since leaving Opal. So if you do want to read any of that, it's all on my website, which is ameliaboonracing.com. Cause I've figured out a lot of how I've figured out things is by writing about it. Yeah. And so that's been my therapy.
Thanks, Amelia. And again, just a total delight. So if you're interested in Opal and you want to learn more, please visit us at opalfoodandbody.com. Thanks to David Bozzi for editing and Aaron Davidson for the Appetites original music. See you next time.